Okay, well, I'm Adrian Benepi. I'm 51 years old. Today is June 5th, 2008, and we're in the StoryCorps booth at Foley Square in Lower Manhattan. I'll be interviewing my father, Barry Benepi.
Go through this.
I'm Barry Benepi. I'm 80 years old, and today is Wednesday, Thursday, June 5th, and I'm sitting in StoryCorps at Foley Square, and I am the father of Adrian Benepi.
All right, so I'm going to be interviewing, so why don't we start at the beginning, talk about when and where you were born.
Well, I was born here in New York City, and to my father Robert and my mother Marjorie. I was the second son. I followed my brother by 6.5 years. We were both born in New York City. At the time I was born, we were living at 9th Street and University Place in sort of an artist studio apartment in a newly constructed building. And we only lived there about 1.5 years. I was born in a hospital off Stuyvesant Square. I'm not sure of its name. I just can't recall for sure. I still have the birth certificate, and I should know, but I don't.
And you had an older brother, Bruce.
Yes, Bruce. He died in roughly 1968 of prostate cancer, fairly young age. He had been president of the company that he took over from my father called Leacock & Company on 5th Avenue, 235th Avenue, a company which imported linens and sold them wholesale around the country. Quite a successful company. Initially, it was mainly hand-embroidered linens. During World War II, when they were cut off from supplies from China and Portugal and India, they relied mainly on domestics from the Caribbean and went in more into cottons and linens and prints more than embroideries.
Now, your father wasn't a New Yorker. Talk a little bit about him.
Yeah, my father came from a large family. I think he had 8 brothers and sisters, and he was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. The Benepi family, if there are any Benepis around, they're part of this family. They stemmed from a family which, or a man and maybe his brother, who came over from Switzerland, I think first in 1798, again recorded as a first Benepi born, was in Canton, Ohio, in, I believe, 1801, but I'm not sure about that. The family was grouped in 2 different parts of the country, the Midwest and California. And my dad always referred to, well, we don't want to know about the Benepis from California. They're just a bunch of cattle thieves. the only ones that counted were the ones who were in the Midwest, who were quite political. His brother, my Uncle Lou, ran for state senator. He was defeated. I'm not sure what party he ran under, but he was defeated by the opposition, who linked him to communists by dropping leaflets from the air with his picture on one side and the name of the communist candidate on the other. Kind of underhanded campaign.
Shocked.
Right. I did eventually...
Now, your grandfather, Lewis, was he a doctor?
Yes, he was. Yeah. My Uncle Lou was a dentist, but my grandfather was a doctor. My other uncle, Jim, was a doctor. There's a lot of doctors in the family. My mother's father is a doctor, so it tended to run in both sides of the family. My mother is Marjorie Berry, born in Portland, Maine. I spent springs and summers with her family early on in my life. I knew my grandmother and Berry better than I do any of the other grandparents. I don't remember either my grandfather's nor my paternal grandmother.
Yeah, that's you never knew Lewis, or I guess Hattie was...
Hattie, yeah. Right.
What do you think of the family legend that maybe Hattie might have been African-American?
Spurious. I know she looks funny in her photograph and sort of darker-skinned, but that's all it's based upon. There's nothing else. There's no literature or letters, as far as I know. I don't have nearly as much history as I'd like to have because nothing was passed along. And the best research was done by not a Benepi, but a Bennett, who was a descendant of a Benepi. And, of course, I have this much of this material, and it has to be passed on to you and others to really complete the work and see if Mr. Bennett is still living so we can gather his help.
Well, what was it like growing up as a child in your family? Would you describe yourself as a happy child? What did you do?
That's a very interesting question. I was in a very protected environment. My chief caretakers were a Portuguese couple, Maria Manuel, and Manuel I knew as Nani, but Maria was always Maria. And my parents were very social. They were out a lot, cocktail parties, dinners. And so I was more in the care of Maria and Nani than I was in their care. And so Maria was really more the mother figure in a certain way. She was the one, if I was sick, was looking after me a lot. And in fact, if I was really sick, she was sleeping in the adjoining bed, or my brother might sleep somewhere else. My brother and I, until he went off to school, and mind you, since he was almost 7 years older, he was off to school and I was still quite young. By the time I was seven, he was away at boarding school. And she would clip my toenails, and when I was a child, bathe me. So she did a lot of the motherly things. And strangely enough, Maria and Nani would be off on Sunday nights. That was her night off. And those were the nights I had a repeated nightmare, which is kind of interesting.
So they were sort of in some ways more your parents than your parents were?
Yeah, yeah, to an extent. And I saw my parents, especially my father, as rather the ogres of discipline rather than the loving presence. My mother, as I became an adult, I found my mother more easily approachable to talk to, although I was certainly aware that my father cared a lot. When I was sick, he would bring me presents, and on Saturdays, he would always take me up to the office on Fifth Avenue, and he encouraged my drawing. My mother did, too, because she was an artist. Mother was a illustrator, freelance illustrator, did work for Lord & Taylor's, a lot of fashion drawings, those stick figures, the things you see in helmets. And I think, and this is, again, sort of hearsay, she never told me this directly, but my father persuaded her to give up her professional career because, according to the hearsay I heard, at a cocktail party on, I think, after they had moved to maybe 45 Gramercy Park from 9th Street, or maybe to 1 Lexington Avenue, both on Gramercy Park, at a party, and both apartments, at least the one on Lexington Avenue, was a duplex, so... You know, this was during Depression years, and people would sort of say, how can you afford such a... My dad overheard a conversation going on between people at the party. Could they afford a place like this? And somebody responding, oh, don't you know, Marge has a great job making $200 a week, which was a lot of money then. And so that really assaulted his manhood, and he persuaded her to stop working so he could be the sole breadwinner. That is the myth that I picked up. Is an interesting one. One of the other myths I picked up, which was sort of funny, that she loved parties, she loved entertaining, she loved, as she would say, getting gay, you know, having a gay cocktail party and chatting. And one apocryphal story was that she got on top of a piano and began singing songs. But when I grew up, she liked to dance with me. She's very sentimental. She was a very caring person, but sentimental was the word. She was an interesting person.
As you were growing up, do you remember the first time you had a thought of what you might do when you grew up?
Not really, but I had interests which bridged a lot of divides. I'd read the comics and go to the page which says archaeology. I like Prince Valiant because it's about history. And I liked the non-comic portions, which dealt with the mastodons and early life. And I wasn't so intrigued with Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, rather as more the things that dealt with early history. And so that was the direction. And we moved to the farm in Maryland when I was 10, and I collected everything I could out of the woods and the fields, and I got interested in mineralogy, and I had a mineralogy kit as a gift, and some friends of my father's who ran a mine in Dodge, Wyoming, or Colorado, mining for copper ore, sent me great samples of copper ores of various kinds, malachite, nazarite, fool's gold, and then native copper embedded in quartz crystals. So that really sparked my interest in this earth sciences. But as I approached college, I thought I would do what my brother did, and that is moved in the direction of the firm. And the firm of Leacock and Company at that point had a lot of dealings with South America. And I thought I would, I took a course in Spanish. I went into economics thinking I was a good preparation for business. And I managed to get something like a glowing B minus in economics. And my teacher would comment on the papers, well, you have all the right answers, but you don't seem to show much interest in the subject. Which is true.
You were, I remember seeing notes about you from your, at a certain point you went away to St. Andrew's School, and I think from an early age on, you were thought to be kind of different. You were, you had different ideas, as they said, you know, and you were had very, you had sort of, you were unusually talented as an artist, as a child. Did you feel like, I mean, you, sounds like you tried to make a move into the corporate world, but didn't you sort of always know that you were different, or did just other people know that?
Yeah. Going back to the beginnings and, in school, in grade school at Friends Seminary, I won some kind of international award for artwork. I think it was a picture of a boat. I can't recall. I had a great art teacher though. And also I became, because my brother left and I was still quite young, I never played much with him. In fact, he was like Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is my torturer. I recall once when I was running down the hallway in our duplex apartment, he put out his leg and tripped me, and I had a really serious fall. And we'd be walking down the road in Maryland. He punched me in the stomach. He said, "You got to keep your guard up." So I became very self-reliant, and I learned to enjoy playing alone. I became very inventive in my life. One of the things I liked to do in the farm was collect arrowheads. That was pursuing the archaeological bent, and I was fascinated with the treasure trove of things to be found in the fields. And
talk a little bit about the farm. How did you end up? You were a city mouse. How did you end up becoming a country mouse?
We did, of course, have access to the country as a child. As I said, I spent time at my grandmother's house. It's called The Camp on a lake, also in the Springer House in Portland. And then Dad had rented a house in New Jersey at town right at the north end of New Jersey, Atlantic Highlands. And we had a two-car garage and this convertible Packard. It was a marvelous car. And that was in the country on the edge of a bluff, and the railroad ran underneath. And then after that, during the mid-30s, we rented a house in Bermuda near Palm Ridge. And this was a place that had no cars. It was just wonderful. Everything was I learned to ride a bicycle there because that's how you got around. And I learned by them putting me in a bicycle and then shoving me off, see if I could stay up without falling over. And so that was a real taste of the beauty of nature. He bought the farm in Maryland in 1938 when I was 10. I was still going to school at private schools in Manhattan, beginning with Friends Seminary and then Browning School. And then St. Andrews was chosen when I was 13. We already were in the farm, and St. Andrews was, and I have no idea why he picked a farm in the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
We went down there last year, last fall. We went on a trip. After hearing about this for decades, I finally went to visit the farm, and it's really just as magical as you describe it, if not more so. A really beautiful part of the country on the banks of the Wicomico, I think.
Yeah, the Wicomico Creek.
Yeah, and but so you got to this place was possibly a McKim-Meaden White House with a great big tower with turrets and a huge wraparound porch and a swimming pool with a colorful past of colorful owners. It sounded like a whole world opened up for you when you got out there.
It did. And of course, until I had a driver's license at the age of 16, it was kind of a lonely world. My friends were either in school, which I didn't see during the summer, or one or two friends happened to live nearby. And so I maybe became dependent for friends, people on the farm. And a large part of a farm is a black community. So my closest friend was a young black boy who lived on the farm, Leroy. And by that time, going back to my artwork, and I was in St. Andrews during World War II, I was painting. One of the things we did at St. Andrews was go up in the tower of the building to spot for enemy planes. And I learned the profiles of Japanese airplanes, not German ones, Japanese, strangely enough. Here we are on the East Coast.
Right.
Then I was doing war bond posters. One of my biggest paintings was of a dead soldier lying in a pool of water in a trench with his arms hanging, and was done in kind of lurid colors. And then shortly after that, and going to Williams, I entered into a student competition, and I entered in two categories. One was mixed media and the other was oil. And for my oil, I submitted a portrait. It was my second oil painting in my life, and it was a portrait of Leroy. And I found it really challenging because of his dark brown skin, so I put him against a blue background so that the color highlights on his skin would be blue rather than yellow or white. And I like the contrast. And then the background was a kind of a deep, strong blue, somehow like you see in Van Gogh, although I don't know if I was that aware of Van Gogh then. It must have been. And that painting won a first prize at the student show. And then the other painting was mixed media. I chose to work in pen and some charcoal and some watercolor and ink. And it was one of the few paintings I did out of my head. I might have done a sketch, but it was based upon watching a student listening together to a recording of music in the library. And the library had these high windows, high vertical windows. And the three students formed a composition. It was a pyramid with the student who was listening at the record. And they all had earphones, so they were all listening. And the student at the record player had his head supported on his arm. So that became a big element, the first triangle. And then the second triangle were the figures themselves. And the third interlacing triangle was the light coming through the window, shining on them. So there were kind of different things going on here. One was a sharing of the sound, which couldn't be heard because it was recorded over their microphones. And the other was the inspiration, which came from outside and which was symbolized by the window.
Do you have either of these two works still?
I had borrowed the second work. I don't know what happened to the first one. The second work I gave to my girlfriend as a wedding present, Beverly Rogers. And she subsequently lent it back to me, and I had it framed and sent it back to her, so she has it now.
While you were at Williams, you had an acquaintanceship with somebody you worked with who was very much into musical theater, and I think you might have built some sets with him.
Yes, Steve Sondheim. And we together worked on the Class musical, which he wrote the music and lyrics for, which is a series of sort of vignettes, and each one had to be accompanied by a scene, but we didn't have time or resources to build scenery, so I painted the scenery on big glass plates and was projected on the back of the cyclorama. And so I would, between classes and up late at night, paint the scenes. I remember one of them was a mad scientist laboratory, and I forgot what the others were.
Well, what was Sondheim like as a kid in college?
Well, I just remember him as a composer, and he was brilliant. The music had a really captured the lyrics well, and that was alive and very vital. I didn't know him socially, really. I only knew him to work with in this thing. I sang in the Glee Club. I sang in the choir. I took my course in music at MIT, actually, later. But Bob Barrow was our conductor, choral conductor, and he worked us very hard. And he got us in shape to do a concert at Carnegie Hall, which we did jointly with a chorus from Bennington, women's chorus, and Paul Bepley, who had a New York City chorus. So there were three choruses brought together at Carnegie, plus the Philharmonic to do the Mozart Requiem Mass. And it was really exciting to do it. But something funny happened during rehearsal when, I think it was probably the Dies Irae, and Barrow and I rehearsing just our men's section kept on saying he wanted it to be, Bepley would say he wanted, Barrow never talked about feeling. Barrow talked about technique. And he wanted us to be very powerful with this. And then at some point he stopped us and he said, too much Benepi.
I think a lot of people felt that way over the years. You know, you're growing up on the farm, you mentioned like a lot of people worked on the farm were black. They lived there on the farm.
Yeah.
And when we went back to visit, you know, there were people there who were young teenagers working the farm when you were a young teenager.
Yeah.
And there seemed to be a very special bond. And, you know, it's sort of, you grew up in a sort of high WASP society where there probably wouldn't have been a great deal of tolerance for that kind of intermingling. And yet you had a very humane aspect to your life all your life. And your many of your friends and your wife, Judith, are Jewish. Mixed very easily with African Americans as a child, as an adult. There isn't, growing up, I knew there wasn't a prejudice bone in your body. Is that something that came from growing up on the farm, or is that just, it was just your nature? You have a real ease with all kinds of people, which I think has helped you do great things in your career.
Yeah, well, I won't claim I'm not prejudiced. I discovered prejudice myself about 20 years ago when I was down at the fort that's run now by the federal government, the former aquarium.
Castle Clinton.
Mm-hmm. And the two guides, they were both black people. And I caught myself with a presumption that, oh, this black person's not going to know history as well as a white person might. And he was so well informed, it blew my mind. And it's one of the few times I caught myself with that kind of attitude. But it's probably hung on to some extent. But I recall my mother, when I was on the farm, saying, well, black people can never be as intelligent as we whites. That was the only expression of prejudice on her part. The only other was, she would ask if so-and-so was Jewish, which is a question would never come to my mind. I worked for Abe Geller in my first job as an architect. He was a very talented architect. I was very glad to get the job. And he couldn't even pay us. You know, he was so poor. In fact, Abe had me return when I went out to look at one of the houses he had designed. I stayed there overnight. He asked me to take back a pair of trousers he had borrowed out of the closet of his client, which he needed. But my mother asked this question, oh, is Mr. Geller Jewish? And again, I didn't know. It never occurred to me to think.
Well,
that's the thing.
It doesn't occur to you. That's always been part of it. And the obvious warmth with the people who had essentially been maids or field hands to you when you went back to visit and go back to visit is kind of extraordinary. Yeah. You made some choices in life that maybe your father and mother, you know, weren't ready to support. You married my mother, Jagna, who was a Polish immigrant. She wasn't part of that, you know, WASP society. You decided not to go into business but to pursue a career as an artist. Talk a little bit about that. That was a point of sort of, you know, not real confrontation, but really a breaking point with your father, probably.
Yeah, it wasn't as severe as one might think. Both mother and dad encouraged me in art all the time. And my dad, in fact, as I said, we used to walk to the office on Saturdays, and he would do his work in his office and put me in. He had a graphic designers who worked there, who prepared the designs for the linen prints, for the cotton prints he made. And he gave me pads and pencils and the color materials he had there. In fact, he had his designer work with me a few times on art lessons. One of the people he hired for a while doing design work was my cousin, who's since died. So he was interested in visual arts. He collected art. In fact, he had one time told, he didn't tell me this, but I heard he had a blue period of one of Picasso's, and we still have a lot of his American work, Robert Phillips, Sawyer, and so he was obviously, and he encouraged the artwork, and he was never one to say, oh, you should go into business with me. It was sort of a natural direction, logical conclusion I was making. I'm not sure why I came to that conclusion. If I had my druthers, you know, about education, but this is a radical kind of thought, is would be the same form as taken in the 15th century as you go into training with the artist you want to work with and you go into early apprenticeship and develop in a field. The way education is today, oh no, you don't specialize at a young age. You go on and on and on, learning all the tricks of the trade of the different trades, and finally concentrate if you're going to go into medical school or law or something like that. Cooper Union, where I went to, was based upon you go into three different arts and then make a choice. At Williams, you're required to take basic courses in different fields as you move through.
How did you go from art to architecture?
Well, first of all, it took me a while to get into art and architecture. When I was at Williams, and this, I had a, what did St. Paul of Damascus experience. I had a vision of what I should be doing, and it occurred because, and again, it was the encouragement of my father to an extent. In my junior year, I had been majoring in economics, and I had taken my first course in art my junior year, had an extremely good teacher, was head of the department, named Lane Faison Jr., who lived to a very advanced age, only died about 2 years ago. And when I took this course, it was like an eye-opening. It was just, the door was open to art and history, and it brought everything together. My dad financed my trip to Europe, in which further opened my eyes to culture, because I could see when I went up in the tower at Long Cathedral and saw the graffiti carved into the cathedral walls, carved in, not written in, and with the dates 1535, I said, oh, this is ancient graffiti. and so the whole experience of my Western culture being opened up to me, and I've had the good fortune of coming back, going over and coming back on a ship, so that 5 or 6 days in the ship gave me time to imbue this experience, to reflect on it and to think about it. And when I got back, I decided I should really major in art. I went to see Lane Faison, and I said, I want to switch from economics to art. And he agreed to it. And it was like a great blessing, because it meant I could concentrate for the first time in one field and took nothing but art courses my senior year. And that enabled me to spare where did I want to go in art. And
can I interrupt for a second?
Yes.
Can you talk about that trip and having that, actually walking into an office to have to tell someone you're going to make this life change? Were you nervous? Were you?
No, I wasn't nervous, really. I felt it was like going into your... One time I considered going to the ministry, and I had... in fact, I think the head of the... church at Gramercy Park, Calvary Church, Sam Shoemaker came to me while I was in the hospital with an infection. He came to visit me and he thought I should go into the ministry, and I thought it was nice that he would think so. My mother was very touched by the idea. But and it was similar when I went to see Faison, although I initiated the visit, it was like going to Buddha and say, would you accept me into the church? You know, I'm a believer. And
did he give you a hard time, or was
no,
he,
on the,
he welcomed
I think
you right
not.
Away?
He was a great person. He was hard to define him, but he had a great sense of humor and seriousness at the same time. When I took the comprehensive art exam at the end of my senior year, and the comprehensive is very broad, and you look at works, and you act as a critic, and you discuss them in a paper. And then the three guys, Whit Stoddard and Bill Pearson and Lane Fazin, Bill Pearson was in American art mainly, and Lane Fazin was a broad picture, and Whit Stoddard was more into medieval art, and I think some sculpture. And they read my papers, they would try to, the papers had no signature on them, so they didn't know what papers they were reading. And I got a report back from Fazin later that they would say, well, who wrote this great piece on this work? And Fazin said, it must have been Benepi. And Whit Stoddard would say, no, he could never write that.
You have a way of looking at things. You have a way of seeing art and color, cityscapes, streets that I think few people have. That first trip to Europe, is that when you first started to understand how cities work, especially the old sections of cities?
Yeah, it was, first of all, the great eye-opening there was a contrast between country and city. And medieval cities have very sharp boundaries, and you could see this later on when I went there in 59 from the air. The edge of Rome was clearly the edge of Rome, and this is part of history, is because the countryside was owned basically by rich families and the church, and they didn't permit development, and they didn't need development. They had all the wealth they needed from taxing their subjects. So that the countryside was defined by medieval society, basically, and that moved forward in the current society, still maintained. So that's what I experienced. And I would bicycle into the pure country, no traffic. It was beautiful. It's nirvana. And then the cities were exciting. They were bubbling with culture, with architecture, and they still are today in Europe.
I'm going to take you back briefly to Maryland, to Princess Anne. You... In 1975 and 1976, you created the green markets, the farmers markets in New York City that then became the models for farmers markets all across the country. You know, the rumor has it is that you were able to taste tomatoes right from the field there growing up on the farm in Maryland, and that since you couldn't ever get that in the city, you started green market. But it's probably more complicated than that. But
yeah.
Does the childhood experience of the farm play into how you started Green Market?
I didn't realize it. It did, but I didn't know it at the time. I thought only two experiences were coming into play there. One was my experience as a planner and seeing how farmland was being taken over by development, and the other was as a consumer in New York, seeing what rotten quality to the vegetables and fruits in New York coming from California instead of from nearby farms in Long Island and New Jersey and the Hudson Valley. And so I saw this double whammy attacking farms, bad marketing and bad land use practice. And I married these two and look at the models of other farmers market, especially in, I think it was not Rochester or an upstate community, and the work of writing of John Hess and working with my colleague, Bob Lewis. He was actually my employee, and really we had a two-person firm, and we put this concept together, farmers market, as a way of solving a planning problem, not agriculture so much, or a planning food problem. And it was only later my father reminded me about my experience in the farm, which I had not remembered in my mind. But that obviously was what made me move in the direction of farmers
market. You used to load up the truck and drive to the wholesale market in Princess Anne.
I did.
Yeah.
As soon as I had my driver's license, I would drive and get in line at the auction block of a line of lots of other trucks. And all of these, my father was fortunate. He had a business supporting him in New York, so he could afford to buy a farm. But he wanted the farm to pay for itself as a farm, not to subsidize it. So he worked hard at making farming profitable. But it was difficult for farmers to subsist then because the auction block was a fraud. The auctioneers did not bid against each other. They took turns buying. And the farmers would be so upset, they would be disgusted and want to go home without selling their load and take it home, but they couldn't afford to. I learned the hard way that farmers were not making money growing food. He would send my brother to Baltimore to the wholesale market. Sometimes he went once to New York to sell string beans. I didn't make those trips.
Yeah.
So I learned the hard way the difficulties of farming, and yet the beauties of farming, of what good vegetables tasted like.
I'm going to just go totally out of the subject of career and stuff like that. You've had five kids. You've been married three times, mm-hmm. and the third one, the longest of them all. What do you, in your life, you've made some amazing accomplishments as a as an outsider. You created one of the greatest innovations this city or any city has ever had. Anything that you're most proud of, and any regrets of things that you didn't do, either in your personal life or your professional life?
Pride is not quite the right word. Happiness is probably more accurate. And what happened with Green Market was seizing upon the times of the cooperation and love and help of lots of people, lots of agencies, including yours, including Henry Stern, who, although people like to portray him as somebody who was not helpful to the market, he obviously was. I was put off by the idea of putting a farmer's market in a park. They didn't belong in parks. It was only because someone in the Lower East Side felt their park was in desperate condition, and a park brought into the entrance of the park would help bring it at Tompkins Square Park and help bring some life into it and security and safety. But we ended up having many markets, not in parks, but on the edges of parks. And it's a good place to have it because it meant there was green around us rather than traffic. But there are many other cooperative city agencies. And perhaps the most helpful one was the Department of Consumer Affairs under L.A. Guggenheimer, who was all gung-ho for farmers markets. And then the Department of Transportation, especially under Ross Sandler, who expanded Union Square to make more room for farmers, because at that time it was being controlled by highways and traffic, not parks, even though it was parks jurisdiction. So gradually we moved into incorporated city spaces, but there were no suitable spaces for markets anywhere in the city. Union Square was the closest. We were working on closed streets. We had to move parked cars. It was difficulty all the time, putting up signs and letting people know where we were because we were hidden away someplace. The city still doesn't have good public places for events. It needs to go a long, long way to get there. And that's part of my effort as a planner, reshaping the city so it's more friendly to people on foot. That's been my goal for 30 or 40 years.
In your life, your personal life, talk about your family, your wives.
Well, I never thought of myself as a good husband, good family member. I love my children on Sundays. We did things, like my father took me to his place on Saturdays. I was not really a good full-time dad. I read stories, made up stories, made things, made a dollhouse. But I depended a lot on their mothers for the real upbringing, the direction. Your mother was fantastic. She was a brilliant woman from the day I knew her and before, very caring, very determined. And the mother of my next three children this was new to her, and she wasn't quite grasping raising children quite as fast, but she did very well with them. She was an artist as well. This rubbed off on at least one of the three children, and two of them really, who went into the arts. But Andrew, being the oldest, was the first to grasp hold of being a creator and is still one today. Simon, the youngest, is still a creator and works more with the camera than with the drawing, although he's done a lot of drawings. And Callum moved into the music field, so they're all more.
Would you, if we all wonder about a chance to go back and do something differently, would you do anything differently if you get a chance to live your life over?
Yes. Only one thing I would like to have explored more is my work as an architect. However, that would have required really giving up everything else, because architecture, one teacher once said to me, is 90% business and 10% design. And that's true. And it's even more, it's probably 95% business today. And so packaging and getting art accomplished as an architect would be extremely, I'd have to be totally devoted, but I sometimes have visions in my soul and my head of what a great city would look like. I'll sometimes make sketches of some thumbnail sketches of, would be more in my mind than anywhere else.
You went to hear a lecture by Frank Lloyd Wright when I was very young.
Yeah.
I think you were carrying me or something. You went up to talk to me at the lecture.
No, you were walking because you're older than your sister and you're both walking. But you were just walking, and it was a graduation talk he gave. I think it was Sarah Lawrence. And Jag and I arrived late.
For a change.
Right. And so as we got
I think my father will be late to his own funeral.
Right. And it was at the enclosed courtyard outdoors, and the applause was just ringing as we walked up to the entrance of the courtyard. So we were at the entrance, and he was walking out, and you stood out in front of him and blocking his way, and he stopped and looked down, and he put his hand on your head and said, "And he will be one someday, too."
He'll be a great, what did he say?
I think he will be one someday, too. Not saying one
he
what.
He didn't say one what. That'll be the great mystery, though, huh?
Yeah.
It's like, kind of like Rosebud.
Right. But there are very few encounters I had seen Wright personally, but he impressed me once when he came into a room to talk to some architects. And when he walked, and this was a cocktail party before, so the room was abuzz with people talking and milling, and he came into the side of the room to go up to the speaker stand, and I don't have this ability he had. When he walked in the room, he would look around the room and notice people. I'm more shy. I think you're a little bit that way. You don't have that capability of looking around and seeing who's there and making eye contact. A good politician does that. But he would look around and engage people already as he walked in. And another time when I called to find out his hotel to see how long he's going to be in New York because I had missed an event, and I said, "Is Mr. Wright staying here?" And they said yes and put me right through his room. And he answered, and I apologized for interrupting him, and I said why I called. I wanted to say how long would he be here. And I could see him looking off in the distance as he spoke on the phone. He said, "No," he said, "I'm going home now." And those are the last words I heard from him.
Yeah. Well, if I can ask,
sure.
Of coming to a close here.
Yeah.
Adrian, how do you describe your father to people who don't know him?
Well, he's a very very complex guy. As I was talking earlier in the interview, he sees things that other people don't see. You know, not like dead people running through the street. He sees color and shadow and form. He's really got the eyes of an artist. You know, I think that, you know, like a lot of very creative, talented people, having a family was, somewhat of a cinder block around his neck. But he grew into the role of fatherhood, and he's still growing into it. At his 80th birthday, which we celebrated a few days late last weekend, he said, "Well, I'm 80. I think I might finally be turning to an adult." And all of his friends said, "Not a chance." Yeah, he's been somewhat of a child all his life, in the best sense. You know, very very creative, a little bit pugnacious, but just he always asked questions. And he, as an advocate for his causes, and it's not just the green market; it's the zoning and planning and historic preservation, farmland preservation, getting cars. he led the effort to get cars at Central Park.
Since 1966.
He was annoying in the nicest possible way. That's how he got all this accomplished. He would persist with people, and they would want to do things for him because they liked him. And he was always very nice to people. A lot of the advocates we work with and some of the gadflies just annoy you. And that's why he was able to get things done. He's just persistent about things. But he's also got this very deep interior life. And one of the things he's done all his life is both make and do wooden jigsaw puzzles, and he gardens extremely well. So there's this part of him where he just likes to be alone, or sometimes socially gardening or doing puzzles, but it's not really time for talking. It's a time for being part of this world, this sort of intimate world of images and shapes and colors, both in garden lands. He has a beautiful garden upstate where he's moved a lot of piles of rocks around and totally reshaped the land, but there's an interaction where I think he's very happy interacting with the physical world in an intimate way.
That's right on. One sort of postscript was that I'm a member of a couple of things in Saugerties. One, I'm chair of an Historic Preservation Commission, and I work on a comprehensive planning committee. And our committee is made up of a broad range of citizens. Some of know something about planning, and most who don't, but have very strong opinions. And I was replaced as vice chair of the group when I wasn't there by a man who I thought was kind of totally disinterested in planning and just was there to listen and look not too vitally interested. We're now down to a working group and mostly 4 to 5 people meeting weekly. And the man who's vice chair has been attending faithfully each of the working group meetings. And he said just on the meeting this week, this past Tuesday, when we're discussing issues dealing with mining, and I was putting mining in the context of larger land use control issues, and he said how much he had learned from me. And he said when he first came on, he didn't believe in protecting the landscape, but now he really sees it and understands it. And he said, Barry's really taught me a lot, but he's like years ahead of his time.
And he was as a child. And he's just passionate about this. I think this is what has kept him so young. He sometimes, you know, when I'm with him, he'll sometimes just be really going at me about something in a park, some design aspect, something that should be changed. I feel like saying, you know what? Instead of asking me about the park, let's talk about your grandchildren. I'm trying to change the subject. So,
if I can ask one more brief, hopefully a brief answer. We're running a long time.
Yeah.
But Barry, what do you see of yourself and Adrian?
Oh. I would say the very things he was describing me as a person who loves the outer world and what shapes it. And that's why he's doing the job he is. I think he's totally devoted to his work as parks commissioner, but going beyond that, he's devoted to the city and what makes the city a great place to live. So he would be good in a role as mayor.
no thanks. But,
his sister told me once she wanted to be mayor. But it's nice to be ambitious that way because it shows a real caring, and that's what I like about him. And what links me with him in this context is this carrying forward of caring about the city. And his mother was the same. His mother was, Yagna, was deeply caring about the city, worked very hard with groups on the Lower East Side to make life comprehensible and better to people living there and putting them in control of their destiny. So that's what I see as a continuity, and the continuity of the family to some extent. I think our family in general has been more socially conscious of doing things for the public benefit rather than private wealth. And I can see it in a lot of my extraneous family members from all over the country.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Yep. Good.